Welcome to the official podcast of the Chalcedon Foundation, a think tank for the self-governing Christian. In a time when Christians are looking for answers in revival, rapture, or the religious right, Chalcedon presents a comprehensive biblical worldview that calls believers to their covenant responsibilities in order to advance Christ's kingdom in every area of life.
Thanks for joining us today, April 19th, 2026, for Chalcedon Podcast number 65. I'm your host, Andrea Schwartz, and I'm joined today, as usual, with Mark Rushdooney, president of the Chalcedon Foundation, and Martin Salbretti, who serves as the vice president. Today's podcast will focus on the biblical doctrine of property as a foundational principle of biblical faith. The book of Genesis begins with the triune God creating everything that is. As its creator, God owns every aspect of creation. The Ten Commandments can be viewed in terms of how God, the property owner, directs how his property is to be used. For a quick summary, Commandments 1 through 4 deal with how we are to relate to our Creator and those basic things He commands and those He forbids. Commandment 5 is the commandment where God relegates to the family how it is to exercise authority under Him. Commandment 6 deals with God's mandates regarding life. The 7th, what constitutes treason against the family. Number 8 deals specifically with property rights and the use of the land as given by God. Commandment 9 deals with truthful witness governing the use of speech and ends with number 10, which is somewhat of a, in case you missed any of the prior stuff, God forbidding man's envy to operate in so-called legal, although unlawful ways. So in essence, all have to do with how to live in obedience to that which belongs to God, his property. In today's discussion, we'll take a deeper dive into a theology of property and how we can better understand and be faithful to Scripture. So, Mark, let's begin by identifying what the Bible means by property.
Well, property is what God gives man for his needs and to further his kingdom. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Therefore, property ultimately belongs to God, and we are the caretakers of it. But we sometimes, in modern society, we've secularized such things as property, and private property has now become sort of a lawless thing, where really another form of humanism where the individual has rights that in fact do not actually belong to him. And we've lost sight of the fact that property is a trust from God.
We should add that one of the distinctives of the modern humanist view is that property is the result of, say, the Big Bang. It just exists and it's mindless and has no moral component behind it. And in the biblical view, property was directly created by God. It's his handiwork. Therefore, he invested work in it to begin with before he turned it over to man to be a steward over certain parts of it. At least the earth is created for habitation and for development, for proper dominion. And so there's a driving purpose behind property from the very get-go. There was no property in Genesis 1:1 until God created it, and therefore it has the impress of its creator's wisdom on it, and power and authority, and his justice and his righteousness. And so all these things are embodied in property, and for us to basically denature it and remove all these features that God has imbued property with is to destroy the idea of property, to make it an abstraction as opposed to a very real product of God's creative wisdom, which has then been transferred to God's image bearers, us. And then the title deeds have terms in them. And that's where we're going to be discussing today. So it's very important to realize that property is very personal from God's point of view. It's his work. Heavens declare his handiwork, but so does the earth itself. It's also the result of his handiwork. In fact, in some respects, even more so, because living things are here. And they also constitute God's property. Yeah, he owns the cattle on a thousand hills, et cetera, et cetera. And so we're accountable for every element here in the creation. So you have to see it as the creation of God, who is the creator. And that already, just by talking about property, means we set a distinction between the creator and the creation, and it's, and an obligation flowing from the creation to the creator by virtue of having been the result of his work, of his effort, of his intended purposes being manifested here in the realm that he created. And had he not created it, there'd be no property. So we're talking about something that would not exist were it not for God bringing it into existence and laying the laws for its administration.
So our Declaration of Independence lists life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Do either of you think it would have been a clearer statement, life, liberty, and property?
I think it would have been to the modern mind, but it was, I think, very clear at the time that the pursuit of happiness can only come through the ability to be somewhat self-determining, and God's means of man being self-determining and providing for himself, providing for his family, was through this idea of private property. And what we call private property really comes basically from the commandment, thou shalt not steal. So someone has to have control over the property and primary responsibility over the property, someone on the human level. And that has been given to families, really, not just individuals, but to families for the good of the family. And so to the modern ear, it would have been clearer, but I think it was pretty clear, especially in colonial America, of the need for private property. Because you have to remember, in colonial America, both in Plymouth and Jamestown, and probably other places as well, their first experiments were in socialism, because companies came over to establish those early colonies. And they thought cooperative efforts would be the safest way to go. And those universally failed, as communal companies or communal efforts tend to fail. And when they went to private initiative, things went much better. So the colonial understanding was the need for the freedom to use one's property for the good of their families.
We can add that many historians have observed that the original phrase that had been circulating up until that point was life, liberty, and property, all three very concrete elements, and that it was Thomas Jefferson who, at the very last minute, swapped out what's called the very vague phrase, pursuit of happiness, for property, on perhaps deistic principles, not theistic or Christian principles, but rather a concession to the humanistic side of things. And therefore, and I think Rush Dooney, your father, Mark, made the exact same comment in his series of history books or lectures on the topic, that in fact the original phrase, going back as far as you might want to find it in the prior writings, going back to I don't know if it was Locke necessarily, but certainly Rutherford and others, that in Montesquieu, I believe the phrase was in fact life, liberty, and property. And then this got shifted by Jefferson's input into the process, and we've suffered ever since. Because now, of course, property is not considered listed in there, and therefore is subject to socialistic impulses, because why not? They see this as a plus, that the restriction on guaranteeing and reserving this for man as a safeguard no longer exists in this alleged founding document. And we can thank Jefferson for this declension in the document, this deterioration of the original doctrine.
So how do you respond to critics who say, well, people who live in America just stole the land from someone else, so someone's always taking land from someone else? Isn't that a very man-centered way to view this, that we've left God out of the picture if it's just we have to go back to who originally claimed this land, because none of us created the land?
Maybe that's a tough one for anyone to jump in on, because obviously it's a controversial issue. But the element of dispossession certainly is present in Scripture at several different levels. For example, the entire world, perhaps in the possession of the unregenerate, is going to be given over to the regenerate. The unjust are accumulating wealth that will ultimately be transferred to the just, to the righteous, to God's people. So there is a dynamic in history, and that's the kind of the point. It's dynamic. It's not necessarily static. The only guarantee that you would be able to keep property or have a continual perpetual claim to property under biblical law is if you are covenantly observing the requirements for that land, and therefore God would bless your staying in the land and would say the sword shall not go through the land, and you will not be subject to any kind of depredation, any kind of evil attacks and attempts to procure the land for some other purpose, to simply steal it, if you will. So whether land can even be stolen in the first place is an interesting question. But when we put that point out, I know that Dr. Rush Dooney kind of took it back a step. He said, all right, so there was a previous population in North America of a pygmy people, and they had their land taken from by those that became the North American Plains Indians. So no one's making a big stink about this. So he said, so in process, we have these things happening in history, and apparently they're always going to be directed toward a certain enemy. Now, that doesn't mean that Americans were right in breaking any of those treaties. You know, covenant violation, a covenant breaker, is a very serious charge laid out in Romans 1. It's one of the most serious of all the things that God is frosted about and judges harshly. And so I believe we have a price to pay for that blood that was bloodshed in the breaking of treaties, because that meant that we covenanted and then broke the covenants willfully. In fact, some of them might have even been tricks in order to secure land and move people around as cattle almost. So the dehumanizing factors there are something that had to be dealt with. I think, therefore, it's very fitting that Dr. Rushuni himself spent 8.5 years on Paiute and Shoshone reservations, having an outreach, pastoral outreach to that population of those who had their land taken. But the answer was not the Bureau of Indian Affairs, as you would find if you read Dr. Rushuni's book on the American Indian. So sometimes things are set up simply to create a new government agency to solve the problem, and then the problem's compounded and made infinitely worse because the fix is destroying the character of the people that it's supposedly trying to help.
We could add that the greatest dispossession of people from property is because of taxation, particularly inheritance taxes. How many family farms and ranches are in the same family that they were in even 100 years ago? When one generation dies, the next generation can't afford the reassessment of taxes. Inheritance taxes can be devastated and in effect necessitate the sale of the family property so that the government can get its demand. And so we have undergone, in the U.S. alone, we've undergone multiple generations of dispossession. And so dispossession is a serious thing, but it takes all forms. And we have to recognize the great dispossessor is the government in our day.
So when people talk about the American dream, being able to own your own home, that sort of is a euphemism for so long as you pay your taxes to the state, then it's your home. But it's not really your home, because if you don't pay those taxes, then it will be taken. Taxation does designate ownership or supposed ownership, does it not?
Well, it certainly presupposes lordship on the part of the taxing party, especially if you're going to tax the land. It means that the government owns the land, is imposing a tax upon it, and is marked the massive dispossessions. It may not equal Noah's flood in impact, but it's as universal in government taxation, extracting wealth and removing property from the control. A serious present danger on the concept of eminent domain. Eminent domain is the prerogative of a god. And unfortunately, the state exerting eminent domain is asserting its godship, its authority to rule as ultimate over everything, including the land that's under your feet. So you might even pay your taxes and lose the land because it's that the will of the god of the system, whether you keep it or not. And so it's not, taxation is the, I guess you could call it, more civilized form of the dispossession. But when push comes to shove, then eminent domain is to play. And that card comes onto the playing field, and boom, property is no longer yours. It's simply taken. You know, the vineyard that Ahab simply decided he was going to secure on false pretenses became his through a process of eminent domain. Now, there was trickery involved, right? There was the false charges, etc., that allowed him to steal it. It was a gift from his wife, Jezebel, very thoughtful. But eminent domain anyway, and murder implicated in it, and of course the theft of that property from the family to whom God had intended it to be in perpetuity. So eminent domain really is the other mechanism. And so if taxation fails of its purpose, eminent domain is the backup plan, because both of those elements are the prerogatives of a sovereign, of a lord, of a god of the system. And we need to recognize that this is a very dangerous place to be, because two gods cannot occupy the same place at the same time, you know, Jehovah and the state. And so there's going to be a conflict, and that conflict is going to be waged between God and man. And man always fails that test, because when it boils down to a test of strength, no one can defeat God. And God's measures are pretty severe when he brings the state to bear and exposes its false foundations, that in fact it is not a god, it is even less than a man, because it behaves like a beast.
So I was reading through 1 Samuel, the part where Samuel feels like he's failed because the people want a king. And God lets him know, nope, you haven't failed, Samuel. It's that these people are asking for something and they really don't know what they're asking for. And he even gives them an opportunity to think it over, you might say, when he says all the things that will happen. Well, we can fast forward the clock and we're looking at modern taxation, taxing our income, taxing our things we purchase, taxing the land, taxing inheritance. So I know, Martin, you've talked an awful lot about the tithe. Why do people prefer paying taxes over tithing as God commands?
because one asks of us responsibility, and man wants to shirk responsibility. He'd rather have an irresponsible option. You see, it's the same reason that people would rather not receive a poor tithe. They'd rather receive a government check because they don't have to say thank you to anybody. They simply say, that's my entitlement. I'm entitled to that check, as opposed to a very generous gift from the church to bring them out of poverty. Then they have to say thank you, and they do not want to be beholden or have to do that, because that is a responsible act of gratitude. And so man does not want to be grateful. He wants to always assert his rights and his entitlements. And therefore, with the status system, yes, we are enslaved, but we're entitled slaves so far as we're concerned. And so we paint this wonderful picture of how wonderful it is, this slavery. The Road to Serfdom, as I think Hayek's book totaled it so well. And that's the path that people are on, because we do not want to be responsible. We want to be irresponsible. By the way, this plays into the whole concept of property. As Dr. Rushdoony observed, property is the most responsible form of wealth. The most irresponsible form of wealth is cash, because it simply can be blown anywhere you want and spent on anything you wish. And therefore, one is biblically oriented to inculcate in man his responsibilities before his Lord, and the other basically allows him to squander his inheritance very rapidly, just like the prodigal son did.
So I mentioned at the beginning, because I was really thinking about this, how the various commandments dealt with property, God's property. And commandment number 5 about honoring your father and your mother clearly places the family under the primary area where God's commands are supposed to be taught and carried out. Do you think that much of what we've seen in terms of efforts to destroy the family understand that the family is God's major institution for dominion, and so you have to undercut God's people and the family in general in order to achieve the tyranny that actually is intended?
I think there's a very clear desire to see the family basically cut down to size. Whenever you have a competing authority, it's a challenge to your authority. If you're trying to establish your authority as the state in any level, and you look at where what might be a challenge to your family, and it's either another government institution, such as, you know, another like the county level versus the state level, and that has to be addressed. Also, this socially, you have to look at where the authority structure is, and that's why there's a terrible war on the family that's been going on for a long time. It's why the authority of parents has been put into question. In the Soviet Union, it was common for the schools and the educational system to encourage children to report on their parents. I think it was even more so true in Romania. Your children could not be trusted because they would report on anything in the home that went against what they were being taught in the schools. And so, yes, you look for anything that might challenge your authority, and you move against it. And I think that's very much in view in our culture. It has been for more than a generation, more than my lifetime, certainly.
Yeah, particular contending authority that Mark is referring to is generally the state, or various agencies of the state, whether it be public school system, et cetera, which contends that parents have no rights over curriculum or anything related to their children, or even not even allowed on campus unless the government lets them. But the reality is that a contending authority can be anything that wants to compete against the family. Most notably in Scripture, we have Jesus condemning the authorities, saying, you know, you will take away what is rightfully to be given to you, mother and father, and make it a gift. It is korban, as the phrase goes in the New Testament. And by that way, you actually nullify the commandment of God concerning, and this is probably the 5th commandment and other adjuncts to it, about taking care of your parents. Instead, you take care of the temple and make sure that the gift of the temple, by giving it to them, that means that your responsibility to your parents is undercut, because the temple now says, well, we are the first place to drop the money, the most important place to drop the money. Just like, well, when Mark alluded earlier to inheritance, the plan of the state is to say, well, we want to have a large inheritance, but maybe it's 100% inheritance in some places, but they're talking about, again, about 50% inheritance. So the state becomes the very firstborn, in essence, to get all this extra money. And the rest of the literal children of a man have to divvy up the other 50% if they get that. So in all these cases, we have to realize that the contending authority against the family is not necessarily even the state. It can be the church, it can be the temple, as it was in Christ's time. And there was a time when, hey, the harvests are bad, we need to throw the children into the fire. So at that point, again, we have the same issue, is that the family is to sacrifice for the sake of the collective, if you will, which is always the state going to dictate whose children are going to be thrown in the fire to placate the deities out there. Obviously, a very anti-Christian situation, but people passed their children through the fire to Molech all the time. And it was considered acceptable. The Roman position about the family was extremely autocratic. You know, the father could say, I want to sell my daughter to this, and I want to kill my son, and that'd be perfectly okay at that point in time, because the family had such little meaning. But it was only the Bible that magnified the family as the foundation. All the families of the earth shall worship him. We read this in the scriptures. And so they are central to this aspect of the extension of the faith into all the world. The conversion of the world is through the agency of families, as we read Psalm 22 and other passages in scripture. Consequently, we need to see the family as important, and that's why Dr. Rashtuni's books point out that the family is the basic structure of society. And when that is being hammered and destroyed by various usurpations, and that's what these stated in the church are doing, extracting authority from the family, from the father, then we're in a bad way. It doesn't help bad mothers either that parents can be pretty miserable and seeing through their responsibilities. That's because the church hasn't trained them to do that. The church was interested in other priorities, and therefore we haven't understood that strong families make for strong churches. Strong property rights make for strong families, make for strong churches, make for a strong nation. But you see, we have set this all aside and wanted to do things top down, which is the statist way.
You know, funny thing, I homeschooled, so my children didn't have the opportunity to learn how good the state was because we taught them otherwise. But when my son got his first job, whatever the minimum wage was at the time, he had calculated how much he would make. And he saw his first paycheck and he said to me, "How could you let this happen to me?" Because he didn't figure in that they would take taxes out. And I don't know if everybody has that experience right off the bat, but he certainly wasn't used to it because he knew things like "thou shalt not steal" and "I worked and they promised me this or that." So whether it's confiscation of your wages, which is interesting because if it was legitimate and you could trust people to go and pay it, right? They know that people won't go pay it if they have to pay it. So that what they do is they make the employer take it out for you. But isn't the confiscation of property always the initial step towards state tyranny?
I believe, yeah, they want to turn up the temperature of the boiling of the water to boil the frog in slowly. And so it takes all these various steps. We see, for example, in scripture, there's a mandate, and I believe it's in Leviticus 19, to the effect that someone is to be paid on the very day that they do their work. In other words, the unit of work time-wise is a single day. It's not a week. It's not a work week. It's a work day. And therefore, it says you will not allow their wages to stay with you overnight. In other words, this is called defrauding the worker. So in the biblical concept, those wages are your property, and they do not belong to the employer at the end of the day. They belong to you, but the employer keeps it. So we've had this feature creep, if you will. We've had this intrusion into the biblical categories of justice, and we have fraud already creeping in just because we have a weekly paycheck instead of a daily paycheck. It was argued, well, we can't do that. And yes, you can nowadays with computers. In fact, I just saw a Tractor Supply that says we also offer daily pay options. So a lot of people are starting to jump on this frame. I remember when Rob Monster was pointing out that in his particular company, they were going to look at doing at least script on a daily basis as an alternative to cash because it's equivalent value in order to honor God's requirement here. So we start small, and every single concession means that we've set a new threshold for the kind of pain we're willing to tolerate in terms of exactions against the family, imposts and duties and taxes, etc. And all these things are simply seen as part of the system, and therefore we just treat it as the cost of doing business, which is a tragedy, because were we to push back and show any kind of spine at all, the state actually would have to wither and die on the vine. It basically can operate the way it does because of the consent of the people who are being sacked by it, in that sense. I would call it the consent of the governed, but I don't think it's really a governance so far as that we're simply being taxed continually. And these taxations, as Mark correctly observed at the beginning, are a form of dispossession. And it's usually the family that is the direct object of dispossession. Nowadays, they're willing to even dispossess you of your own children, let alone the money in your bank account or the property that you're on via taxation. All these are mechanisms which are a tax on the family in order to create a new foundation for society, which is the state. And everyone, therefore, has their value not in the family, but in the state. The centralizing aspect is a key subverting process, as Dr. Rashtuni would call it, that allows this process to go forth. And unless Christians call a halt to it and set in place alternate governments in the midst of the other government. For example, this was happening, as you well know, with the abortion on the river Tigris, I believe it is, Tiber, my river's mistaken up, where the babies that were abandoned were being collected by the Christians to raise as their own. And so there is a form of government. You're taking care of something. This kind of helping of the neighbor is something that Russia frowned upon. You were not supposed to help your neighbor in trouble, because that was a form of government that was suddenly in contention with the massive government and that was supposed to do the job, but failed. And so the one thing the government hates is being shown up for doing a miserable job. That's one reason that Christian schools are hated so much, because the results academically are so much superior to the public that it makes the public schools look terrible in comparison. So they have to raise all sorts of objections to why we need to put everyone on the same equal footing. And that footing means, of course, is to take away the prerogative of a family to see to the training of their children. What was originally a family prerogative now becomes a state's prerogative. And this is where Dr. Rushdoony's work has been so important in setting a new tone over the last half century.
Andrea, you asked the question whether the confiscation of property was a first step towards tyranny. And I would say, no, it actually means you're already there. You're already there if the government has primary right and the ability to take your property. That is tyranny. You know, the difference between, well, when I was in school, I was given a definition of communism and fascism that I've always remembered, and I think it's a good working definition. Communism is when the government claims to own everything. Fascism is when the forms of private property exist and you have title to things, but the government has control over it and can dictate to you. I think the difference between communism and fascism and the confiscation of property through our various tax schemes and inheritance taxes is just a matter of degrees, but it's all wrong. It's one of those areas where if we really wanted to ever get back to a biblical culture, we're going to have to fundamentally we think government and what government is allowed to do. And a lot of people are very critical of the Constitution, and I see why, but our Constitution was the first attempt to structurally limit government and its ability to do something. I don't think it's functioning that way anymore, but I think that's going to be the future of a more Christian society, is if we can get government hamstrung. And I think one way government is going to hamstrung, and one of the things this is going to end, I don't think it's just going to end in a massive totalitarian government, because government is failing in one area after another. When their money fails, they haven't been able to take enough by taxation. And so now they took over with the Federal Reserve System, the bank. That's in effect our national bank. And they're creating currency. When a government's currency loses value, its power diminishes. That day will come. I can't predict when that's going to happen. But eventually, the printing dollars isn't going to work anymore. And at that point, our government and governments around the world are going to lose their ability to control. And something else is going to have to take its place. And I hope that's a new era of freedom. But things will change. There is change on the horizon. But what form that takes, we do not know. But we're well on the road to tyranny.
So you mentioned communism, fascism, socialism in general. A lot of people will juxtapose those are the bad things, but capitalism is the good thing. And capitalism, divorced from biblical law, is just another way for one group of people to get what they want. Could you go into that a little bit, either one of you? Because I think that these things are, instead of private property, free enterprise, which is what I believe the Bible is talking about, people blanket all these things under capitalism.
Well, capitalism really refers to this idea that capital should be under the control of individual ownership. As we've said, ownership really ought to be more properly understood and biblically as sort of a trustee with family authority. Remember, the land, for instance, in the Old Testament was given to the tribes. The tribes allotted it to the families, and they could not permanently sell rural land, which was most of the land. Houses in the towns could be bought and sold. But outside the towns, it could at most be what we would call leased. In the year of Jubilee, it would automatically return to the family. So you could have a long-term lease and give up your land, but it went to the next generation in the year of Jubilee. And so there was this stability. And there was also a permanence because even the irresponsibility of one or more individuals did not cause that family to permanently lose that property. It would automatically revert to them. And as I alluded to, the multiple generations of a dispossession that we've had in this property in this country in the last 100 years alone is incredible. And this is one of the problems with our economy. So capitalism is a very limited term because my father used to say humanism took two primary forms throughout history, anarchism versus statism. Anarchism is when the individual thinks he's entitled. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. I'm my own boss. And we see that today. We see that very often in conservative circles today. There's a branch of conservative referred to as anarchistic or
anarcho-capitalism.
And that is an emphasis on the individual and individual rights. On the other side of the coin, on the other extreme, you have statism. And that's a bigger problem. Anarchism usually doesn't last long because it's weak, because it's only one individual against everybody else. And it's very difficult for the individual to maintain that posture, whereas the state collectively has a lot more power and can usually overcome. So the state has been a much bigger problem throughout history than this individualism. But the biblical model, it's really this idea of property held in trust. We still have the idea of trusts and family trusts, but it's a legal term, but we need to make that more of the, return it to this social structure and sociological implications of trustee ownership.
And when we talk about the land, Mark mentioned, of course, that the Jubilee provided for a return, a repossession. But there's also elements of dispossession in God's laws regarding land. For example, in capitalism, pure capitalism, you say, well, we're unrestrained. We can do with what land what we want. We can plant it continuously. Well, this is where God steps in and says, every seventh year, the land is to lie fallow. You're not to produce on it. It's supposed to let the crops just fall to the ground and refertilize and replenish the land. And when Israel decided for quite a few cycles to simply ignore this commandment all the way through to Zedekiah, they missed 490 years worth of land Sabbaths. And that point, God says through Jeremiah, my land shall enjoy her Sabbaths. Now notice here, it's God's land. It's God's property. Always was God's property. Everything in Israel was God's property. He says, you are going to be expelled to Babylon and my land will enjoy 70 years of rest that you denied to it. So God again sets the stipulates the rules of engagement with property. And here the capitalists would have to then back off and say, if we want to be successful capitalists, we must observe that there are guardrails that God has put in here. And if we fail to observe them, we're going to have a problem. If we decide we're going to continue to have a debauched currency, then Micah 6, 9 through 14 is going to come into play. And we're going to have an implosion of the whole nation because we have the treasures of wickedness in our in the scant measure here. That is, God says, he will not hold anyone guiltless who has them in their possession. And that would be the capitalist who says it's okay to use Keynesian economics. So you see, everywhere you turn, God has something to say because God maps out the path to liberty and freedom and blessing. All the other paths, the white path that leads to destruction, always has these concomitant aspects, like a dispossession for violating God's land laws, for all the other aspects. And finally, when you hurt the family, you actually hurt the nation as well. Russia found this out very, very early on, that making the family a non-entity, basically, and de-emphasizing it, harmed their productivity, among other things. And people didn't have anything bigger to live for except the collective. And that wasn't very meaningful over against those who believed that they lived for something truly bigger than themselves, that is the God, the living God. And so we can see from point to point the aspects of both possession and dispossession of land, and that God sets the terms. The anarcho-capitalist doesn't see that. And the crony capitalist wants the state to help him manipulate markets and say, I want you to set up a law that the only person who can, only kind of thing that we can sell is this kind of thing, this kind of margarine, that kind of butter, this kind of milk, et cetera, et cetera. So all these barriers are put up to favor one person against another. And so all these are liberties that are being taken away and extracted on no moral basis, but rather because it favors somebody. And at that point, we have the crony capitalism, which is extremely destructive of a nation. And the Constitution doesn't support it, but politicians do, because politicians benefit. And therefore, we cannot trust them to be other than bramble men, as Dr. Rushdoony called them.
It's interesting, because when I mentioned the 10th commandment, crony capitalism is a perfect example of doing things legally to get what you want, but clearly unlawfully according to God's law.
Exactly right. And we have a lot of it because the payola is of interest to the politicians, because they have to do their part to send the contracts a certain direction and to steer things a certain way, in a favorable way. So whereas the Bible requires that there be no partiality in any judgment, particularly even economic judgments, here partiality is shown, and consequently the system is corrupt because envy is now elevated to the governing principle.
So you brought up land Sabbaths, having land revert back to the ownership of who got it. And a lot of times when you're reading through a book like the book of Leviticus, it's easy to say, well, that land is in Palestine now. And so there's obviously controversy theologically that that land belongs to the nation of Israel. How do we apply the idea of not only land Sabbaths, but things staying within family in the midst of where we are right now? Because a lot of people don't feel like they can leave anything really to their children because the state's the first heir. I also know that Jesus gave us a great commission. So it's not like this parcel of land that we're supposed to conquer. It's the entire earth. So how would you, for somebody who's saying, I don't know how this would apply to me or how I would actually apply it, what would you say?
Well, one's financial planning needs to include future generations. And one of the primary reasons, given our laws that vary from state to state, estate planning is very important. My father encouraged people constantly to plan their estate, because there are legal ways to structure your finances so that you can provide for your heirs, or you can provide that your, if you have no heirs, that your assets go to a place where, you know, to a purpose that you choose. And so it is entirely possible to do it, but it's much harder. It doesn't just happen because of you wish. And the idea of somebody once wrote us into a handwritten will, those are pretty much worthless in most jurisdictions.
We should point out that to restore the family in any way, shape, or form requires the setting up of independent governance. It starts with the children and their schooling. This is the first major effort to detach ourselves from the teat of the government to which we've been attached far too long. I just was encountering a quotation from Spurgeon yesterday where he said it's absolutely critical not to rely on the government for any money for these purposes. He's talking about the Stockwell Orphanage in particular. He said that it's a disaster and he doesn't count on the government to do anything well, especially this. And he's writing this in about 1880s. And already at that point, the handwriting was on the wall about it, how bad the government was as to its administration of resources. We all know this because nobody is fooled anymore by the idea that the money you put into Social Security is being saved for you in a lockbox, as Al Gore said. There is no lockbox, never was, never will be, because they raided that Social Security fund a long time ago. So the original promises were broken and trampled underfoot, and they laugh at us because we're still forced to put the money in, and it barely covers the cost of the obligations, that entitlements that are being part of the system. As Dr. Gary North said, those kind of massive entitlements have never been repaid in the history of mankind, and they're much bigger now than they've ever been. So again, alternatives to the status quo, to the government systems, are important. That means that self-government of the Christian then has to start to grow into how the family governs itself and has that long-term plan, that generational awareness that Mark alluded to, is critical. To think beyond your own generation, to think about a generation not yet born, to use the phrase in Psalm 22:31. That is the key. And if we're not doing that, then of course we're showing our hatred for our children and grandchildren. But if we love them, then we're going to take the steps to detach ourselves from government reliance, because that is simply a way to weaken us at all levels. We become irresponsible when we just turn everything over to the government. And so that's why Chalcedon teaches this very unwelcome message about increased responsibility. In fact, we're not increasing it beyond what God requires. We're simply saying we haven't even got up close to what God has expected of us. We have a big surfeit, and we need to get that deficit gap closed, and we have to do this multiple ways. One way, of course, was Christian schooling and homeschooling. That's the first step, but then we have to do it economically in other areas. People are starting this process of mapping out what would it take to have this and have the blessing of it. Those counties that start to move down this direction will be blessed in a way, and then people will catch the vision, and it'll expand and grow as people become aware of the implications of liberty and freedom being realized when biblical law is honored and obeyed. And then God even blesses the land itself. You see, the land is subject to a curse upon it. It will not yield its strength up to you according to the scriptures because of the sin. And then, of course, in our case, innocent blood being shed into the ground in the abortion holocaust that is currently prevailing in our nation. So the land is not giving up the best of its properties to us, and no amount of chemicals is going to change that. So, but the alternative, of course, is righteousness. It turns out that that blesses a nation that restores the productivity of the land. The land will yield her strength when we treat it as a good steward, not as basically a predator on the land, thing that we can do with it as we will. And God can be neglected in the equation. In fact, God is the determining factor in every equation. And when Christians realize that, put that into play at every level, starting at the small levels, then it'll work. So you see, sometimes we simply say, it has to be big, it has to be top-down. This is not true. The solutions start small and then build their way up. It's a quiet revolution, as we've heard that phrase used here in Calcedon in the last couple of months. And I think that's an important way to look at it. It's a quiet revolution, but it's very profound because it changes the entire way of how God is going to relate to those who are operating in terms of his law, in terms of his plan for the creation.
It becomes very easy, especially in election years, to blame the state for everything. If those who get the idea that we're under a tyranny sometimes just get their jollies, I guess, by complaining about it. But the first culprit to deal with, it seems to me, is that since dominion's inevitable, that believers need to understand that the church's dereliction of duty is what created a vacuum that the state and other places were more than willing to fulfill or to move into and fill. So the real question is, are we prepared to work hard, even if, I know, Mark, you like to say this, you might not even see it in your own lifetime. Are we prepared to do what we're supposed to do in obedience, not necessarily saying, okay, God, you're on the clock. I want to see that I'm being blessed.
When my father started speaking of Christian Reconstruction, he was speaking largely to conservatives who were really disillusioned because a particular conservative candidate had lost the presidential election in an absolute landslide. And the Great Society of Lyndon Baines Johnson was just a juggernaut. And the Democrats had a majority in Congress, and it just seemed like it was clear sailing for an agenda that was pushing far to the left, what was far to the left at the time, in any case. And he was trying to move them into a long-range vision of Christian Reconstruction with the view of the future as the kingdom of God and the lordship of Jesus Christ. And I remember many conversations of people who thought, well, this sounds like a better alternative. Yes. And a lot of those conversations would go something like, I wonder what it would be like living under a Christian educational system, a Christian this, a Christian that. And, you know, it was almost like a pie in the sky thing, like it would be great when the system collapses and we can take over. The question is, what would you do if you had the opportunity to take over? And I think what we are lacking in the Christian community now, as well as then, was a sense of what we would do. How must things be structured different? And sometimes I think to figure out how we can make things work in a more sound structure, we have to see how things are failing under the existing system. When you see failure, you understand a lot. Well, this didn't just fail at one point. There was something behind it that was a bad idea to begin with. And for instance, it's common for people to point out the problems with the public school system because they see an end result that nobody really likes. And I think increasingly we're seeing that in the culture. But do we have the understanding of how things ought to be, so that we could start building from the ground up? Because it's easy to say, well, it would be great if we had this, but how do we get there from here? And that's why obedience, and I think that's why the whole issue theologically of theonomy is so crucial. At least theonomy gives you the big picture that we have to obey God. And now where are we disobeying God? what would obedience look like in this area, one area after another? Because it's easy to fall back into patterns of this was in my father's or my grandfather's generation. Let's go back to that. So obedience and obeying God is important. But we have to think about what does that really look like? Not just in our personal obedience, which is a little bit easier, but socially, what kind of institutions do we have to have? What needs to fail? And how can we replace that with something better? Ultimately, I think Christians have to learn obedience. And I've said this before, I think one of the most distressing things I've seen in the last 50, 60 years is the fact that Christians don't like the idea of theonomy, which means we don't like the idea of obeying God. We can come up with a better way. We don't like what we have, but there's an alternative to doing things God's way instead of rethinking our life and our culture in terms of God's law.
We can add to that that to do the right thing at this point, in many respects, is going to cost you a lot more than had we not failed in the first place. If we had not allowed the public school system to gain hegemony over our children, then perhaps it wouldn't be such a bad idea or difficult to homeschool or Christian school. But the reality is you're paying the property taxes, and we're back on the topic of property, and you're going to pay for the curriculum for your homeschooling system, or you're going to be paying the tuition for a Christian school. So you pay twice. So right now, dig yourself out of this hole. You have to work twice as hard. Now, the very fact that there are Christians who are actually doing this is indicative that there is an appetite for righteousness and for the next generation that allows for that level of responsibility, a willingness to say, yes, we will pay twice because our children are worth it. And it's our fault. We were part of the generations that allowed this to happen. We have to move us out from behind the eight ball into a proper place where we have liberty and freedom. And that's going to entail the extra work. And that's why it's a difficult, but look at the progress we've made. It's been incredible. Now, it slowed down somewhat. It didn't move as fast in the 90s and the aughts and then the teens as it did in the 70s and 80s. But it is still a juggernaut. COVID certainly helped push it a little bit faster along because people realize they cannot trust the state in many respects. So people are willing to pay twice, pay both for the public school education they will not use and the Christian education that they want to use. That's a huge thing because that's an act of responsibility. That's saying, I am going to pay the price to do it right. And it's not easy. I'm going to do the hard thing. And a lot of people have observed sometimes you know the right thing to do because it's the hard thing. In this case, it is the hard thing. And people are doing the harder things. And God blesses that. There's a tremendous down the road blessing both for us and for the generations that follow because someone decided to stop digging the hole deeper and to get us starting out of that hole. And if we do it in that area, we can do it in any area. You know, if you can move it an inch, you can move it a mile, as I've heard many times in these contexts. And therefore, the willingness to do that is there on the part of many Christians. I believe the theonomy issue will probably come into play down the line. It'll become more and more obvious that Christians need answers in a lot of these areas, and the non-theonomists don't have answers. In fact, they kind of make the point that they don't want to have an answer, that God does not speak to these areas. Well, that leaves us back on our own resources, and one thing we've learned about that doesn't work well because that puts us back into statist mind frame as opposed to the family mind frame. So when people realize how family-centric the law of God is and how it promotes the family above all else except Christ himself, then we see something happening and people will catch that vision. And therefore, the level of commitment and conviction we see with those who are willing to pay twice to get their children educated properly and not turn them over to Molech, that will start to reflect it in other areas, in economic areas. It'll affect in agrarian areas how we're going to deal with the land proper in terms of how it's going to be dealt with and whether we're going to follow biblical categories of thought or if we're going to just follow humanistic ideas that it simply is the result of hydrogen exploding out into the cosmos sometime millions of years ago. Whatever the mythology might happen to be that is current, we say no, this is all false. This is all God's property, and we have an obligation because God's going to call us to account. You know, there's a point in time when you're going to be pulled up and sit on the carpet, if you will, and say, what have you done with the talent that was given to you? And so our families constitute the most important talent, if you will, obligation for us, and we need to answer for it. And therefore, property, the handling of family property, becomes an important element of that process.
So none of us, those of us here and those of us listening, were alive when the Federal Reserve was put into place. None of us were alive when the public school system started. And so some people really recoil against the we have been negligent, we have not. But the reason we use the pronoun we is because it's a responsibility God gave to his people. And the more people didn't understand what God's law required. And so a lot of people who understand that they don't want their children in public school, it's not just the Christian education of children, it's the Christian education of themselves. They have to get up to speed. They are a little bit ahead of their kids because they've lived long enough to see the failures of humanism. But I really encourage people who understand this to reach out to new families who are homeschooling and offer to help fill in the blanks that they don't have. I do a class with children of homeschooling families, and they're getting a big dose of R.J. Rushdoony. And I tell them, this is what you're inheriting. You're inheriting this world. God requires you to do something about it. And they give me this look like, wait a minute, us? And it's like, yep, you. Just like their parents had the responsibility to take that step and pull them out of public schools. So I think that we can help each other, especially those of us who have read through things. We can make a mini curriculum out of some of the most important aspects of understanding theonomy so that people get up to speed quickly. You know, the Institutes of Biblical Law is a very big book, but you know what? You can take it a dose at a time. You know, there's no rush to get through it, but there is emphasis on application. And I do think those who listen and are, you know, faithful readers of Rush's work and supporters of Chalcedon can do a whole lot more than they think they can because they understand things that other people don't.
If I might, among that first comment you made about, well, the Federal Reserve was founded in 1913. We don't have any direct responsibility according to this. I think Dr. Rushdoony did a very good job of dealing with this in the book, Larceny in the Heart, because he pointed out, and he quotes all the authorities on the matter, he said that the debauching of the currency, he says the destruction of the currency, which makes it cheaper and cheaper over time and allows us to pay off debts in cheaper dollars, he says, cannot occur unless the larcenous purpose is comprehended by the populace, you see, because we collectively want to pay off debts in cheaper dollars. We get a benefit from seeing that we're getting more money in our purse and the price even and maybe faster than the prices are rising. We have a benefit to that. In other words, we are benefiting from the theft. And because we do benefit from the theft, we are on the hook because all we had to do was to deal with honest weights and measures the entire time, and we didn't. Christians were not theonomic enough to even consider this matter during that time period from 1913 on. So our leaders have led us astray, and we have decided that we are comfortable with being participants in theft, in larceny of the heart. And I think this is an important element to raise because people simply want to push it far off as a historic thing rather than we've been beneficiaries of this particular form of theft. And in fact, we would cry screaming murder if all of a sudden there was a deflation. What do you mean the dollar's worth more? And now I have to pay, you know, now I have to pay off those debts in more expensive dollars. And we bring this point around almost every other one of these podcasts, that there's an element of theft in the very fact that inflation succeeds and people are willing to believe that it's the retailers who are punching up the prices rather than the government inflating the currency, creating the later result of the pricing to balance out the fact that the money supply is being diluted. You're not allowed to have a diluted money supply. You cannot even have it in your purse, according to Scripture. And it's repeated over and over again in Proverbs, in the Deuteronomy, and also in Micah. And so all these passages warn us not to have that. That's why that they couldn't even use the Roman shekels to pay at the Jewish temple. They had to convert them into an honest form of money because the Roman currency, apart from the face of Caesar on it, was also a debauched currency. It was also being inflated by the Romans. So the Jews had a proper one, but then they made all the money during the conversion process. So they made it difficult for you to be honest with your money. And that's the only time anyone bothered to be honest with the money. So, well, in the temple, you have to be. You had to go to the money changer. But the rest of the time, Jews in ancient Israel used the Roman currency because it was an illegitimate shekel. It was a deflated, inflating currency. It was debauched, and people gained the benefit of it. So anytime they were doing that, we show our true colors. So I don't think people should run away with that or hide behind a historic circumstance when, in fact, they are the direct beneficiaries of the theft and would in a heartbeat continue that unless they're willing to repent. There's a repentance that's required to move away from debauched currencies.
All right. I think we've covered the topic. Any book recommendations that either one of you would make for people to get a better understanding of all that we've talked about today? Rush's Systematic Theology, he has the theology of the land. And so that would give us a really good sense of the do's and don'ts. How about you, Martin? Anything?
That's a good one. I do think that larceny in the heart is important because it deals with the element of status taxation and the element of dispossession, how families are dispossessed by it, and how we have moved that process along because of our slavish character. And until that character is addressed, we're not going to do much better. If we are at heart willing to be slaves, then, of course, we're going to be on the road to serfdom that Hayek warned us about. And if we want to be men who are free, then we have to be willing to pay the price for freedom. Freedom isn't free in that sense. It actually entails responsibility in God's world. I mean, the world of humanism, maybe it doesn't. But in God's world, which is the real world, the Creator sets the rules and the bounds of the creation and what is expected of it and how it functions properly and what causes it to be dysfunctional. And when it is dysfunctional, it is reacting covenantally to man's violations of his law.
Very good. Well, listeners, thanks for listening. Join us next time, and we look forward to having another good discussion on things that pertain to what the Christian should do.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Chalcedon Podcast. To learn more about the ministry of Chalcedon, or to discover thousands of great Christian books, sermons, lectures, videos, newsletters, and more, just visit chalcedon.edu today.